Hi, you're listening to the Yale Anesthesiology Podcast. Make sure to visit our show website so that you can take advantage of the links of the papers that will be mentioned during this recording. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Antonio Gonzalez, and I'm thrilled to present our next guest. Dr. Vishal Oppal is an associate professor at the Dalhousie University, and he has an impressive bio. Just to highlight some of his roles, he is the associate editor for the Canadian Journal of Anesthesia, chair of the Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine, and the director of the Regional Anesthesia Fellowship Program at his institutions. Overall, Dr. Oppal's research interests are geared towards improving the safety and efficacy of regional anesthesia techniques in high-risk patient populations. Today, he is here to talk about his article, Consensus Practice Guidelines on Postdural Puncture Headache, from a multi-society international working group. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Oppal.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So I guess, like, you know, anytime we talk about any topic, it's important to start talking about statistics. And what is the incidence of postdural puncture headache?
Great question. And as we all know, postdural puncture headache is a recognized complication of unintentional dural puncture during an epidural insertion or intentional dural puncture, either during a spinal anesthesia or a diagnostic procedure. Its incidence varies widely. The figures which have been quoted range from less than 2% to 40%. It depends a lot on procedural factors as well as patient factors.
It seems like the design of this study, if I get it right, it was a Delphi approach, which is usually utilized to examine and give expert opinion regarding a problem area. And a group of experts discuss what are the topics that, you know, need discussion and consensus is needed.
Yeah, you're right. Delphi approach we used was mainly to generate consensus. During the guideline, we actually conducted proper literature searches to develop the guidelines. And with the literature searches, we combined the concept of PDPH with each of the question which we developed, which we're going to be talking about. That there were 10 questions which were clinically relevant we developed during the guideline formation, and shared it with all the collaborators, which were from 6 different societies, 21 collaborators. And then after each of these collaborator groups generated synthesis of evidence and statements and recommendations, we used a modified Delphi process to actually generate consensus. And we eventually achieved 90 to 100% consensus for all the recommendations and the statements we presented in the guideline.
Yeah, so I think this was an amazing paper. Certainly, the 10 questions that your research team or the group of the Delphi team developed were actually very on point. And these are actually questions that commonly we discuss among ourselves. And a lot of these questions also patients ask about once we are investigating a possible postdural puncture headache. So let's just dive into it. And the first question is, what is the most acceptable postdural puncture headache definition?
That's a great question, because there's been some controversial definitions. If you look at the International Classification of Headache Disorders, they published a definition in 2018. And in their definition, they say that PDPH is a headache attributed to low CSF pressure occurring within 5 days of lumbar puncture caused by CSF leakage through dural puncture. The headache is usually accompanied by neck stiffness and subjective hearing symptoms. And it regresses within 2 weeks of dural puncture or after a blood patch. This kind of definition is a bit controversial in the sense that there are a few issues highlighted in our own guidelines, saying that this definition requires evidence of low pressure. And if you look at some studies, neither the opening or closing pressures differ in patients who have PDPH sometimes. And also patients with the raised intracranial hypertension can actually get posterior puncture headache as well. And then it's not uncommon for patients to get headache after 5 days. And then, interestingly, the previous definition actually included the postural component, which is missing in this current definition. In 2021, actually, ASA, the American Society of Anesthesiologists, produced a definition based on clinical symptoms and history and physical examination. And this is something we actually endorsed, and we defined PDPH as headache or neurological symptoms which may be relieved on lying down and occur within 5 days of neuraxial procedure. In other words, we did include the postural component.
Yeah, I think that definitely that positional headache is extremely important. And in a study of 26,000 patients, only 8 out of 142 patients that develop postural puncture headache did not exhibit a positional headache. So it seems like the positional headache is actually very, very classic of a patient with postural puncture headache. But I think part of our work as clinicians is to keep a high level of suspicion for any patient that has received a neuraxial procedure. Now, we also have to be very mindful of what are the factors that actually increase the risk of developing postural puncture headache. Would you please elaborate a little bit on those risk factors?
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of these factors actually are quite well known to clinicians. What the evidence suggests is that the younger age group, female sex, and history of previous headaches is associated with increased risk of postural puncture headache, whereas the BMI was not consistently associated with increased risk of headache. On the other hand, if you look at smoking history, is interesting because the evidence suggests that it might actually be associated with decreased risk of PDPH. And I'm not suggesting that all of us should start smoking to reduce the risk of PDPH, but it's just an association which was found. And maybe people who smoke are less likely to report headache after after a dural puncture. And finally, we did not find sufficient evidence to link depression or the effect of second stage of labor on postural puncture, risk of postural puncture headache.
Yeah, that was great. And yeah, one of the things one of the risk factors that keep coming up as very confusing is the BMI. A lot of people cite BMI as a protective factor, but as well defined by your team, it is not. There's not enough evidence to suggest that that's the case. Now, what procedural characteristics are associated with postural puncture headache? Or another way of asking this question is, what techniques and resources can I use to prevent postural puncture headache?
Absolutely, yeah. And I have to highlight that in 2018, there was this landmark systematic review, which was published in Lancet by Nath and colleagues, which compared cutting needles, which they call as conventional needles, to non-cutting needles, which are basically atraumatic or pencil point needles, spinal needles. And they showed us that the non-cutting needles significantly reduce the risk of posterior puncture headache after a lumbar puncture. And the effect size, if you put an effect size to it, the number needed to treat was 5. Which is for every 5 patients treated with a non-cutting needle, we can prevent 1 posterior puncture headache, which is pretty impressive. Therefore, our guidelines recommend routine use of non-cutting needles for lumbar puncture for all populations. And the impact of size, especially this is more important if we are using cutting needles, the narrower the gauge of the needle, the lower the risk of postural puncture headache. And then looking at some other factors regarding number of attempts, we can say that intuitively, if you have lesser number of attempts, you're most less likely to get postural puncture headache. Looking at the operator experience, With increasing experience, obviously, the operator experience, the risk of postural puncture headache is lower. But this effect is not as huge as some people believe. So it's a small benefit. And then finally, I wanted to talk about the bevel direction. And this is more important if we are using cutting needles. If we are using cutting needles, which we should not be if we have non-cutting needles, orienting the bevel parallel to the long axis of spine actually might decrease the risk of posterior puncture headache.
Yeah, that is actually, I thought that was very interesting because I was under the impression that that was not the case. The bevel direction did not influence because we didn't know exactly where the fibers are, but it seems like that's not the case. Now, it's interesting to see that the number of attempts and operator experiences may play a role, although it seems like it may be small. And I think this is why I am a big proponent of the use of ultrasound, but that's, you know, it's outside the scope of this podcast right now. Now, what measures may be used to prevent postural puncture headache?
Yeah, that's another very important question. And actually, it was addressed in question number 4 of our guidelines. So clinicians have tried various interventions to prevent postural puncture headache after accidental dural puncture. Unfortunately, not many have shown to be effective. Let us start by discussing the role of intrathecal catheters in preventing postural puncture headache. Some people suggest that leaving a catheter in situ promotes fibrous reaction, aiding closure of the dural hole. However, like all medical devices, epidural catheters are extensively tested and are tested as inert. So it's unlikely to promote the tissue reaction. So after reviewing the evidence, what we suggested for intrathecal catheter was that following accidental dural puncture during attempted epidural insertion, the evidence is actually insufficient to confirm that placement of intrathecal catheter can reduce the risk of posterior puncture headache. And the recommendation which was associated with this evidence synthesis was that after an accidental dural puncture, an intrathecal catheter may be considered to provide analgesia or anesthesia, but this decision has to be balanced against the potential risks associated with intrathecal catheter. As we all know that leaving an intrathecal catheter and accidentally injecting an epidural dose of local anesthetic into an intrathecal catheter can be a devastating complication. Continuing with the same idea of preventing, another intervention which has been suggested is the prophylactic epidural blood patches. That can be actually either done through the catheter itself or as a standalone procedure. However, not every patient who experiences a dural puncture develops a postdural puncture headache. Therefore, the policy of routinely prophylactic blood patch exposes some patients to unnecessary risk. So the recommendation which we came with was a prophylactic epidural blood patch is not recommended as a routine because there is insufficient evidence to support its effectiveness. As we all know that the earlier the blood patch we do, especially if it's done within 48 hours, then it's less likely to be effective. And there were similar recommendations for the bed rest as well. Looking at some of the pharmacological measures, there are various drugs people have tried and intrathecally or even systemically, and the evidence is not convincing or even it's an insufficient to put it more precisely. So these interventions were also not routinely recommended by the guideline.
Thank you for that. And yeah, I think it's very important that, and I thought it was actually very good that the guidelines here are, leaving it up to the providers that it could be performed. Definitely for the intrathecal catheter, I think that, it needs to be taking into account, as you well mentioned, the risk of the accidental injection of medication that was intended to be, given at epidural doses intrathecally, that can have devastating consequences. But I think that as well, it's important to understand that if the procedure was technically difficult by an experienced provider, there may be some benefit to keep an intrathecal catheter. In one of the studies, one of these retrospective studies by Russell and colleagues, they were able to show that repeating the epidural, that at times they had to repeat epidurals up to 41% of the times for patients with accidental dural puncture, and 9% of those patients that they reattempted to site their epidural catheter at another space had, unfortunately, a second dural puncture. So in those instances where epidurals may be challenging, it may be worth and perform with by an experienced provider, it may be worth to consider leaving an intrathecal catheter. Those are, those areas where the benefits may outweigh the risk.
100%. And you make a very, very great point there is if you look at the language of the guidelines, it says that routine use is not recommended, which means that for cases which you are describing, a difficult dural puncture to begin with, it's not a routine use, it's a non-routine use. So there has to be a clinical judgment which has to be exercised when making these clinical decisions.
Thank you. Now, what conservative measures may be used to treat postdural puncture headache?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of conservative measures which have been advocated by people, starting from bed rest to analgesic drugs. Yeah, let's start with bed rest because that's an interesting one, and it's routinely advocated by quite a few clinicians. And we have to think of bed rest as some of these patients might be actually postpartum. So putting them on strict bed rest might actually expose them to risk of DVTs and PEs. Although having said that, bed rest does provide some temporary relief to these patients. So what we suggested was the evidence does not support the routine use of bed rest, but it can be used as a temporizing measure for symptomatic relief. Other conservative measures which have been talked about are fluid therapy. And obviously, we should encourage oral fluid hydration. However, if intravenous fluids should be reserved only for patients who cannot take fluids orally. Some of the other conservative measures like abdominal binders, aromatherapy, and acupuncture had very insufficient evidence, so we did not advocate their routine use. Whereas medications like multimodal analgesia are strongly recommended if they're not contraindicated, obviously. I think short-term opioids is okay, although there was a much debate among people whether we should be including that or not. But we thought that patients should not be denied a short course of opioid if needed. But there is no role for long-term opioid use in these patients. Another important intervention which people use frequently is caffeine. And that is, especially in the first 24 hours, it's found to be a fairly effective intervention. However, we have to be sure that we don't exceed the recommended doses, which is not more than 900 milligrams per day. And if the patient is breastfeeding, they should have it reduced to 200 to 300 milligrams per day. And we also should keep in mind that we should account for all different sources of caffeine when we are calculating that dose. Finally, some other drugs like hydrocortisone, theophylline, and gabapentin, there was insufficient evidence regarding it, so we did not recommend its use.
Thank you for that. Yeah, caffeine is actually very commonly used. In my experience, it doesn't seem to help much. And as you mentioned, it's very important to make sure that we don't exceed the recommended doses. Now, what procedural interventions may be used to treat postdural puncture headaches?
Yes, that's a very interesting and very hot topic, actually, because in our own unit, a lot of people are trying different type of interventions, which are not epidural blood patch interventions. I suspect that's what you mean. The commonest one, at least what we have tried in non-block room previously, has been spinopalatine ganglion block. And if you look at the literature, the technique of performing this block is very heterogeneous. Some people perform this block by using cotton swabs, other just put some drops, and there actually is a percutaneous spinopalatine ganglion block as well, which is done mainly in chronic pain clinics. The proposed mechanism of action for this block is by blocking the parasympathetic outflow from the ganglion, resulting in cerebral vasoconstriction and down regulation of neurogenic inflammatory mediators. On reviewing the evidence, we did not find enough evidence supporting its use. In some cases, it might be actually a pressure effect or placebo effect. So we did not recommend its routine use. And I'm again using the word routine. You know, in special cases, you might want to choose to use it. The other interesting block, which actually I had never performed before, was a greater occipital nerve block, which blocks the C2 dorsal ramus. And it's a simple block to perform, and it's been used for low pressure headache in chronic pain clinics. And obviously, both these spinopalatine ganglion block and greater occipital nerve block have to be performed bilaterally. So on reviewing the evidence, there was quite a few studies which used this block for postdural puncture headache after spinal anesthesia or lumbar punctures and found it to be effective. However, there were very few studies or only one study looking at epidural punctures, and it was found to be effective. So our recommendation which came with this or for this block was it should be offered to patients following spinal anesthesia or lumbar puncture with a narrower gauge needle, something like a 22 gauge or less. However, a significant proportion of these patients might actually end up using an epidural blood patch. Other interventions which people talk about are epidural crystalloids. And on reviewing the evidence, we found that they might provide some temporary benefit, but should not be expected to produce long-lasting effect. The evidence did not recommend routine use of either epidural gelatin, dextrin, or hydroxyethyl starch. But the most interesting one was actually fibrin glue, wherein it's been used for treatment of PDPH. But reviewing some case reports, there have been anaphylaxis or aseptic meningitis secondary to its use. So we said that it should not be used as a routine treatment. However, fibrin glue might have role in these situations where either the headache is refractory to epidural blood patch or autologous blood injection is contraindicated.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. And yeah, I think that most of these procedures, other than the epidural blood patch, which we're going to start talking about very soon, which is considered to be the gold standard for postdural puncture headache, a lot of these other interventions that we just discussed, they are not the gold standard, and they may provide some temporary relief, like, for example, the greater occipital nerve block and the sphenopalatine ganglion block, because they are blocking the symptoms, but they're not really treating the underlying problem. And that is why epidural blood patch, I think it's considered to be the gold standard. Now, imaging, is it imaging required for the management of postdural puncture headache?
Not for routine, but there are certain situations where we might want to consider imaging, especially if if there is a change in nature of headache, like if it was postural and then it becomes non-postural, or the headache lasts for more than 2 weeks, or if there, it's associated with some kind of neurological deficits, seizures, obviously, those are the situations which might warrant imaging or cranial imaging in these patients, but not as a routine. Most of the times our diagnosis is based on the clinical symptoms and signs and the history of, obviously, dural puncture.
All right, thank you for that. And yeah, we started talking about some of the reasons why a patient may not be, you know, why it may be contraindicated to do an epidural blood patch. So we talk about not being able to receive their own autologous blood. So that could be patients with like maybe fever. What contraindications exist for an epidural, for performing an epidural blood patch?
Contraindication is quite similar to what would be for neuraxial procedures in general. And we have society guidelines or on when neuraxial procedures should not be performed. In general, it's been seen that, and this comes from obstetric literature, is if platelet count is more than 70,000, then it's reasonably safe to perform a neuraxial procedure, and that same applies to epidural blood patch as well. As you said, you know, caution should be exercised in patients who have signs of systemic sepsis, and it may be actually best to wait till some of the signs of sepsis resolve. However, we did not find any evidence to support routinely using prophylactic antibiotics before doing a blood patch.
Thank you for that. And I think the last two questions are probably, you know, extremely important, and they cause a lot of debate because of the amount of evidence that there is out there. So the next question is, when and how should an epidural blood patch be performed? So when, in terms of the timing, 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, when is the best time to perform an epidural blood patch?
Yeah, actually, if you look at the data, initially, the study suggested that blood patch has a very high effective rate. It's probably 90% effective. But some of the most recent studies suggest that it might be actually a little less effective than what we initially thought. It's generally seen that performing a blood patch earlier on is thought to be less effective. And this data might be slightly confounded as well, considering that a lot of these blood patches which are performed early are actually for the headaches which are severe, which might actually end up needing a second blood patch anyway. But if you look at the current evidence, the suggestion is maybe we should try at least for 48 hours, a conservative management. And then if the headache doesn't resolve, then we should offer these patients blood patch. And they should be offered blood patch if the headache is interfering with their daily living, especially in postpartum period, it becomes quite important. Also, if the headache is associated with other neurological symptoms, such as hearing loss or neuropathies or seizures, these are the patients you might actually need investigation and a blood patch as well. We talked about the timing of it, you know, but important thing is to follow them up and make sure the headache resolves and it doesn't come back. And if it comes back, then they might actually need a second blood patch as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that it is important to understand that when a patient, as you mentioned, is exhibiting neurologic symptoms or very severe symptoms at the 24-hour mark, it's probably because they have leaked a lot more CSF possibly. And those patients actually benefit from doing an early epidural. I do use this information about the increased failure rate with the patients to discuss, you know, to have a discussion with the patient about the timing and how the timing may require a second blood patch. But if we were to look, and Dr. Scabone did a great paper on these, a great editorial titled One Patch or More, Defining Success in Treatment of Postdural Puncture Headache, she basically very nicely put in there that if we don't patch these patients at the 24 hour, they end up having a huge pain, distributed around their admission time. Whereas those patients that get patched earlier, they have transitions from pain to relief to then pain again. So overall, the sooner you patch those patients with severe symptoms, the better they fare in terms of overall pain. So that's a great editorial that I will suggest everybody to read, as well as this consensus statement. So is there an optimal volume of blood that should be injected?
And that's a great question as well, because this is something we get asked so many times. And it's hard. It's a hard question because it depends on so many factors, mainly patient factors, you know, age, the degree of changes in spine, and the size of the hole in general as well, is like an epidural puncture or is it spinal puncture? So most recommend a volume of like 15 to 20 mLs of blood. But the study suggests that giving more than 30 mL of blood, it doesn't improve the success rate of blood patch. And the important thing is to, when you're doing the blood patch, is to inject the blood slowly and incrementally. And if the patient develops severe back pain or headache, then to stop and only to resume based on the clinical judgment. But generally speaking, more than 30 ml of blood was not recommended by the consensus group.
Thank you for that. That is actually very important information. Very good to know. Now, what are the long-term complications of a postdural puncture headache, and how should patients be followed up?
There was this OA report, which not a lot of people are aware of. It was an article secondary to some of those serious complications happened after some of these patients who had dural puncture and postdural puncture headache were lost to follow-up and developed some serious complications like chronic subdural hematoma, central venous thrombosis, and even a few deaths happened, which prompted the Obstetric Anesthesia Association from the UK to formulate the initial report, which was published in the International Journal of Obstetric Anesthesia. But coming back to your questions, so the long-term complications include things like, which are well-known, chronic headache, backache, neck pain, and depression. And recently, it has been suggested that it's a much more known entity, the chronic headache after a postdural puncture headache.
Yeah, I think that's the bottom line here is that, you know, accidental dural punctures will happen. Unfortunately, they will continue to happen. But what is important for us as clinicians, I think, and our responsibility to the patient is mainly to have very strict follow-up. We can talk about our different institutions' follow-up strategies or policies. At least in my institution, what we do with a patient that is considered to be at a high risk for developing a postdural puncture headache or is discharged with a known postdural puncture headache is that we will follow the patient for at least 5 days after their discharge or 5 days after the accidental dural puncture happened to make sure that they don't develop new symptoms or worsening symptoms. But it's actually very important. We call these patients every day. We make sure that if they don't pick up their phone, we leave voicemails, messages to make sure that we are following up. In a recent study published by Dr. Guglielminotti, the adjusted odds ratio associated with postdural puncture headache for cerebral venous thrombosis was 19. For subdural hematoma was 39.7. For bacterial meningitis was 1.9. For depression, 7.7. For headaches or chronic headaches was 7.7 for headaches and 4.6 for low back pain. Again, what seems to be very important is to do a close follow-up. It's the only one thing that we can control. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I was actually even going to say that even for those patients who don't have an accidental dural puncture, or those who have a simple lumbar puncture, the patient should be informed about the symptoms of posterior puncture headache as well. Because some of these patients, the dural puncture during the epidural insertion is not recognized, and they come to us as later on with posterior puncture headache. And it's hard to follow all of them, you know, it's not practical. But if we let them know about the symptoms which they should be looking for, they can reach out there to their primary care provider or to the hospitals if those kind of symptoms appear. And those patients who are inpatients, as you suggested, probably should be followed up for a few days anyway, even some of those patients who get spinal anesthesia.
Now, I would like to end this podcast with Dr. Upal's top five recommendations for preventing, diagnosing, and managing posterior puncture headache.
If I had to pick top five, I would say that clinicians should use non-cutting needles for performing spinal anesthesia or lumbar punctures for diagnostic procedures. So non-cutting needles for sure. And if possible, use the narrowest gauge needles whenever it's available. As we discussed, a follow-up of these patients is really important, and the follow-up should continue until the headache resolves. My fourth recommendation might be consider blood patch for patients who don't respond to conservative measures, or at least offer them. Some of them might not want to take the risk of another possible dural puncture. Also, definitely consider epidural blood patch for patients who have severe neurological symptoms like hearing loss or cranial neuropathies. And the last one is probably the most important one, as we discussed, is the follow-up and performing urgent neuroimaging or referral if the symptoms worsen or change, like if they have some focal neurological symptoms or change in the nature of the headache. So I think those would be my top five.
Thank you so much for that information. This has been a very enlightening podcast. I really thank you and your team for putting out this study. I can only imagine that getting 21 experts on this field together must have been quite challenging, but at the same time, very great learning opportunity. And we all, as readers of this excellent paper, will benefit from this work that you put up front for us to enlighten our knowledge regarding this very important topic of posterior puncture headache. So I want to thank you for that.
And I have to say thank you to you for your interest and taking effort to record this podcast. I absolutely agree with you. The 21 experts, I cannot thank them enough. It's been just a humbling experience working with them. Some of them who are world experts in their field, contributing their time and effort in producing this document, which will be hopefully useful.
Thank you.